It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Good afternoon. I'm Clay Masters. Iowa passed a law in 1998 making it a felony for someone with HIV to engage in intimate contact with another person without disclosing it. That is defined as the intentional exposure of the body of one person to a bodily fluid of another person in a manner that could result in the transmission of HIV. The law does not specify that the other party must become infected for there to be a crime. Iowa's law, of which 34 states have in some form, has one of the harshest sentences. The bill reduces the penalties for unknowingly exposing someone to HIV. That is a bill in the Iowa Senate and the House. Only Arkansas and Washington are more punitive, with a maximum of 30 years in prison. In Iowa, it's 25 years. We'll talk to a couple lawmakers about this legislative action here at the State House this session to change the law. But first, we're going to talk about Nick Rhodes. Nick Rhodes is an HIV-positive gay man living in Iowa. In June 2008, Rhodes had a one-time sexual encounter with Adam Plendel, during which they used a condom. Several days after, Plendel was told by a friend that Rhodes might be HIV positive, and he contacted the police. The police arrested Rhodes in September 2008 and charged him with intentionally exposing Plendel to HIV. On the advice of his counsel, Rhodes pled guilty, despite the fact that a condom was used, and Mr. Plendel did not contract HIV. Rhodes was convicted and received the maximum sentence, 25 years and lifetime registration as a sex offender. As comparison, the maximum for sexually abusing a child is 10 years. Several months later, the court suspended his prison sentence and placed him on supervised probation for 5 years. Now, that's not where the story ends, but I want to bring in a couple guests into the conversation to talk about the case. I'm joined by Joseph Glazebrook, partner at Glazebrook, Moe Johnston, and Heard LLP. He was involved in Nick's case early on. Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And Christopher Clark with Lambda Legal. They're currently representing Rhodes, and he was at an Iowa Supreme Court hearing last week. He's on the phone. Good afternoon, Christopher.
Thank you for having me.
So, gentlemen, first of all, we'll start with you, Joseph. Kind of pick us up where I left off.
Sure. So, I mean, you accurately described what led to the charging of Mr. Rhodes in this case. And, you know, shortly after that whole criminal process was more or less complete in the district court up in Waterloo, I got a call from my law partner, who was not a law partner at the time, Dan Johnston, and he asked if I'd be interested in taking a look at this case and seeing what options Mr. Rhodes had after having been convicted and incarcerated for that period of time. You know, in the meantime, Mr. Rhodes had been reconsidered for his sentence and had been placed on probation. So he was out of prison at that point. But we decided that, you know, in Iowa, it's a 25-year mandatory. Well, the 25 years is not mandatory, but the lifetime sex offender registry is. And he was still on probation for 5 years. And we decided that, you know, compared to somebody who might commit a voluntary manslaughter, for example, who's looking at 10 years, or somebody who commits rape who's looking at 10 years, it's just unjust that Mr. Rhodes was looking at 25 years, or at least the collateral consequences of that conviction. So we filed a post-conviction relief action, which is a type of procedure that's sort of like an appeal. You go back and you look at what the trial counsel did and see if he fell below a certain standard such that the courts could not countenance his conviction. And so we filed that in early 2010, and then the case was litigated.
So tell us a little bit more about Nick's case. How did he end up arrested then?
Well, you know, this is part of the problem with the way the law is. And he was basically, there was a discussion between the complaining witness in his case and I think a friend, or there was some sort of discussion about, there was this rumor that our client had HIV, and so the rumor led to, you know, certain contacts that were made between Mr. Plendel and others, and then eventually the police became involved, and they did an investigation. They raided Mr. Rhodes' home. They found his medication. They had him in for an interview, and of course a police interview is designed elicit incriminating responses. And of course, the reality is this is kind of a gray area. Under our position, of course, is that Mr. Rhodes should not have been convicted under this law. But, you know, there are prosecutors and others in this state who feel that he should have. And so using the information they gathered, they went ahead with the prosecution.
So how do you navigate the he said, she said aspect of persecution in these cases? I mean, that's a lot of claims. How do you do that from a legal standpoint?
Well, and from our standpoint, of course, filing a post-conviction relief action, we had to gain a lot of the evidence that we believe the attorney who was involved in the trial didn't get when he should have. That attorney only did one incomplete deposition. So we had to go back and kind of build the case up from square one. And so we did that. We filed discovery requests. We took more depositions. We developed the case. And we discovered at the end of the day that the attorney involved in the trial part of the case just didn't do a good enough job.
So what was it like for Mr. Rhodes as he was serving time? Was there a stigma attached? I mean, what was it like for him in jail?
Yeah, and I don't want to get too much into Mr. Rhodes' private life. I mean, certainly this case has taken its toll on Mr. Rhodes. It was certainly not pleasant. He spent, I believe, something like 16 to 18 months incarcerated in one form or another. And, you know, it was not pleasant. I can tell you that I work with criminal defendants in other contexts all the time as part of my job. And, you know, you get used to, you know, certain people, you know, are more comfortable and have been in jail and prison a lot more. Mr. Rhodes had not. He was not a typical criminal defendant. He was one of the nicest clients I had ever met, frankly, and he just did not fit some of the things you see with folks that you represent, and so it just was not a pleasant experience for him.
Christopher Clark with Lambda Legal, you're currently representing Rhodes. Bring us up to speed when you took over the case or continued to or started to work with Joseph's firm.
Right. I should say that Lambda Legal is working with Joseph on the appeal of the denial of Joseph's attempt to get post-conviction relief for Mr. Rhodes, which he's clearly entitled to. And the crux of the arguments made on appeal is that there's really simply no basis to be charging someone for this type of activity. As you mentioned in the introduction to the segment, Mr. Rhodes used a condom during his sexual encounter with the alleged victim. But also an important part of the story is at the time, Mr. Rhodes was on antiretroviral therapy, which is the treatment that's used to the medical treatment that's used to treat people with HIV. And as a result of that medical treatment, Mr. Rhodes had what they call an undetectable viral load, which means that there is so little virus in his bodily fluid that the risk of any HIV transmission to somebody with whom you're having a sexual encounter with is so low that scientists are now suggesting that it may in fact be impossible for someone with an undetectable viral load to transmit HIV to a sexual partner. So we are asking the Supreme Court to take a look at updated information with respect to HIV and how it's transmitted, and that here, somebody who has both used a condom and was receiving effective treatment such that they may, in fact, not have presented any risk of transmission at all, that person should not be charged with a crime and certainly should not be facing the sorts of penalties that are in this statute and the lifetime sex offender registry. So, you know, we're basically asking the court now to take a look at the science and update the law with respect to who can and cannot be charged under this law.
Now, those oral arguments were heard last week. Tell us a little bit about what that was like at the Iowa Supreme Court. What did you hear? How did the judges take the evidence and the initial oral arguments?
Well, you know, we were very excited to have the oral argument before the Supreme Court. We did have an opportunity to argue the case back in September before the intermediate appellate court, and we were very pleased that the high court decided to take the case. It's very difficult to sort of predict where people are at, that where the justices are at with respect to their thought process, but we were happy to engage in a conversation with the justices about some of what I just went over with you, some of the sort of current understanding about how HIV is and is not transmitted. Several members of the court seem to be interested in the points that we were making, so we are, you know, hopeful for a good outcome.
So we're kind of skittering around it, but what is wrong with the current law?
Gosh, there's a lot wrong with the current law and a lot wrong with these laws in general. The biggest issue is that as a result of imposing such extreme criminal penalties on people who are HIV positive and who do not disclose their status, the law actually provides an incentive to people to not get tested for HIV, because if you do not know your status, you cannot be subjected to these sorts of criminal penalties, which is, you know, flies in the face of every sort of notion of how public health officials think we need to combat this disease. Everybody, you know, who is trying to fight this disease knows and tells people the important thing is for people to get tested and to get on treatment. And I want to sort of underscore the importance of treatment here, because the science is now showing that treatment is as effective as using a condom with respect to preventing the transmission of HIV. So the cornerstone of public policy is to get people tested and treated if they're HIV positive. This law provides an incentive for people not to get tested. So that's a huge public health problem with this law.
And Joseph, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I would just echo what Christopher said, but I would also point out that, and we kind of talked about this earlier, but this law ruins people's lives for doing what? For having a sexual encounter that really doesn't pose a risk to the sexual partner. And so if you compare that to other laws in the state, it's just completely out of sync with where other laws are at. I mentioned rape and voluntary manslaughter being less serious offenses than this offense earlier. I'd also add to that list things like burglary or certain types of kidnapping, all sorts of offenses dealing with threatening to kill somebody, all sorts of other sexual offenses, lascivious acts with a minor, all sorts of other crimes that we would think of as being more serious than engaging in an act which really did not pose a risk to somebody. So in addition to the stigma and to the discouraging of acting in one's best medical interests, this law simply ruins people's lives, and it's just not working for the state of Iowa.
So what level of penalty is appropriate in your opinion?
Well, in Mr. Rhodes' case, I don't believe any level is appropriate. I don't believe he acted in a way that should be criminalized at all. Now, you do have an extremely rare situation where somebody intentionally transmits the virus and actually transmits the virus, and perhaps there should be a penalty there. I would certainly not argue with somebody who wanted to penalize that sort of intentional harm. Maybe a less severe penalty than the one we have right now, but I don't really have a strong opinion about what level is appropriate. But the type of thing that our client is accused of in this case really didn't pose a risk to Mr. Plindel, and so we just don't think it should be a criminal law at all in this case.
And Christopher, you'd echo Joseph's sentiments there?
Yeah, I mean, the criminal law should generally be penalizing people who act with a criminal intent, and somebody who is having a sexual encounter where they're using a condom and they are on effective medical treatment simply does not have the sort of criminal intent that the criminal law should be coming in and penalizing this. I sort of echo Joseph's point. You may be in a very different situation if somebody is intentionally out there trying to harm others, and perhaps a law could be crafted to address that, and there may actually be other laws that do that, but this type of conduct is not criminal.
What are your thoughts? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Reach out to us on Facebook. You can email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Now, we want to bring a couple more voices into the conversation. Here in the law library with me are two lawmakers, no stranger to River to River, Democratic Senator Rob Hogue of Cedar Rapids. He's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Republican Representative Chip Baltimore of Boone, the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Both of you, welcome back to River to River.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good to be here.
So, Senator Hogue, tell us, there's a bill that passed in the Senate unanimously. All senators voted for it that were voting. What would that bill do?
Well, Clay, I appreciate the question and happy to be on the show. And I, if I recall correctly, it's Senate File 2297. I think that's the bill number. We passed it off the Senate floor unanimously, 48 to nothing. I was floor manager of the bill and really began with the basic kind of understanding that the current law was badly outdated and draconian. That's my view. You know, when you're being subjected to 25 years in prison, when you don't actually transmit a disease, when you didn't act with criminal intent, seems a little excessive to me. And I think people, we've updated our understanding about HIV. So that's been the approach. What we've done is we've done basically four things. One is we've said we're not going to single out HIV. So the bill as passed also addresses meningitis, hepatitis, and tuberculosis. You know, question there. There are some other transmissible diseases that aren't covered, but those are the ones we've targeted in this legislation. Number two is we've required an intent requirement, so you actually act with criminal intent or criminal recklessness. Three, if you actually transmit the disease and you have the intent, it results in higher penalties than if you don't transmit the disease. And finally, this is really important. We provide what, for lack of a better phrase, I'm going to call a safe harbor, which is if you follow your treatment regimen and the behavioral recommendations of your physicians and public health officials, that is a defense to the that is a defense, and so you wouldn't be criminally held responsible if the person charged can show those things.
And that's the Senate bill. Went over to the House. Republican Representative Chip Baltimore. What does the House version of the bill look like? There's an amendment to what was there.
That's correct, and you know, we also identified and recognized that the existing law is outdated and in drastic need of change, and we certainly believe that that's the case, and we're happy that science and medicine has kind of caught up and done a great job of helping people obviously live longer and live full and happy lives with any of these diseases that we're dealing with. So we're certainly thrilled about that. As we looked at the Senate version, you know, we too acknowledged that we needed a greater degree of culpability here on behalf of the infected person. And we also acknowledged the public health concerns in trying to make sure that people would get tested and follow their treatment regimen as well to try to eliminate the disease. The one area that I thought, or the one interest that we thought was missing from the Senate version, or perhaps overlooked somewhat, was a focus on the victim, a focus on the person who is not infected, who engages in intimate contact with someone who is but doesn't know it and isn't told that. And I think that's an interest that not having been in that position, but I can certainly imagine that that would be very violative. I think a person in that position would feel violated by the fact that somebody would potentially expose them to a disease that may have some adverse effects. And I acknowledge that there's some thought that maybe the penalties should be higher based upon whether or not the disease is actually transmitted. But when it comes to the criminal culpability side of it, I'm not sure that if there's a requisite intent there, that the penalty should be different simply because of the luck of the draw, whether or not someone gets infected. So we changed it a little bit. If someone under the House version, if someone is out there actively trying to and intending to infect somebody else, we left that as a Class B felony, punishable by up to 25 years, because that's not somebody that you really want out there on the street intending to infect somebody else. If you act recklessly or with reckless disregard to the safety of an uninfected person, and they don't know it, then that would be a Class C felony or punishable by up to 10 years under the House version. And then if you just simply know that you are infected and you don't tell someone else, your partner, if you will, then we reduce that to a Class D felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. We also attempted to put in a safe harbor that says if you're relying upon the advice of your doctor and engaging in contact and you don't think that your doctor has told you that there's no substantial risk of transmission, then that does not mean that you have criminal intent and therefore there would be no crime.
So, Joseph, quickly, even in Nick Rhodes' case, there was still a slight chance that HIV could have been transmitted. How do you still protect individuals? Shouldn't it always be disclosed?
Well, first of all, I would dispute the idea that there was a slight chance that HIV could have been transmitted in Nick's case. I actually am of the opinion that under the given facts of Mr. Rhodes' case, it was impossible, or at least it was impossible to prove that it could have been transmitted. It was effectively impossible. That being said, how do you protect people? Isn't disclosure the right thing to do? And I would agree with that the best thing to do is to tell your sexual partner about anything, not just HIV status, but anything that might put them at risk. That's the best thing to do, but that's not the question we're asking here. The question we're asking in this conversation is what is the role of the criminal law in going into the bedroom and making those decisions for people who are engaging in these sorts of activities? And the reality is the criminal law, as my colleague Mr. Clark said earlier, actually discourages an open and honest discussion about health issues because it drives HIV status under the table and it creates a stigma and it discourages people from even knowing their own status, which actually poses a much more significant danger to their sexual partner than knowing one's status and getting treatment.
And quickly, Christopher, I want to go to you before we have to take a break for your reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would sort of dispute the notion that what we're talking about here is in some sense protecting quote-unquote victims. The truth of the matter is exactly as Joseph said, a far riskier sexual encounter is to have sexual encounter with somebody who might be HIV positive but is untested and doesn't know it. People do need to take personal responsibility for their health decisions, for their decisions about sexual activity. Somebody who has intercourse with an HIV positive person who's uses a condom and is on effective treatment, that person is not a victim.
Okay, that sets us up for the second half of the show. Are you or someone you know affected by HIV? Join the conversation with your thoughts. 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send us an email at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be back in the second half with Senator Hogue and Representative Baltimore live from the Capitol Law Library. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. In the last decade, we've increased our understanding of HIV transmission, and medical technology has advanced. But in the 1990s, HIV was still a scary concept, and an Iowa law reflects that fear. The first half of the show, we discussed the Nick Rhodes case, an HIV-positive gay man living in Iowa who was jailed for having sex with another man without disclosing he was HIV positive. Back for the second half of River to River to discuss bills in the Senate and House, Democratic Senator Rob Hogue of Cedar Rapids, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Republican Representative Chip Baltimore, he's the chair of the House Judiciary Committee. So this bill would change a law that currently makes it a felony punishable by up to 25 years in prison to expose a partner to HIV without his or her consent. Under this new bill passed by the Senate, the worst sentencing would be a serious misdemeanor if they found the HIV-positive person was being reckless. Senator Hogue, how did the Senate Judiciary Committee come to the decision about the penalty?
Okay, Clay, I should go through the penalties.
Okay.
Because that's what you've just said, not right.
Okay.
And I know there are some differences between our versions. And I do want to say, This was not a bill that creates a get-out-of-jail-free card, right? This is something that we still have significant criminal penalties. You could, in theory, have a discussion about whether there should be specialized criminal penalties for the transmission of HIV and the other diseases that are covered in our bill. But that's, you know, that's a theoretical discussion. We are have a very practical problem of having an outdated draconian bill on the books, and we've got to make it better, right? We, you know, not aiming for perfection here. We're trying to make it better. So what our bill does is if you have the intent to transmit and you actually transmit, we kept that at a Class B felony. We had some discussion about a lower penalty in that case, and in working through this process, you know, and I'm very proud of the Senate, we eventually got to a bill that got unanimous bipartisan support, and that was important for me. I didn't want to just put up a bill there that had 26 Democratic votes, and I knew Representative Baltimore would look at and say, well, I guess that's probably not going to go anywhere. I wanted to give him a bill that he could look at and work off of, which is what he's doing. So we kept that Class B felony if you intended to transmit and you actually transmitted one of the four diseases. Now, if you intended and didn't transmit, we ramped it down to I'm going from memory here, a Class D felony. And if you were reckless and actually did transmit, that would have been a Class D felony. And it was only if you were reckless and didn't transmit would you be down to a serious misdemeanor. And you know, again, the actual transmission of the disease is not something that should be irrelevant. It makes a big difference to a victim. If somebody transmits the disease to me versus not transmits the disease, that makes it a big difference. So those were the penalties. We worked through a process. It took a lot of time, but we worked through a process of bipartisan support. Worked a lot with my ranking member, Senator Schneider from West Des Moines on that. Senator McCoy, Senator Sodders were leaders on the Democratic side. Senator Whitfer from Ankeny, very helpful. And we worked through this process trying to get a bill that would get bipartisan support, which we ended up doing. And now Representative Baltimore's got it over there, and as is his right, he gets to work on it and figure out where he wants to be and his caucus and his chamber. And I still am pretty optimistic we can get something done this year.
And Representative Baltimore, when it came over to your chamber, how did you accept it and how did you realize what you talked a little bit about taking into account the victim, maybe refresh a little bit about what that amendment would do and sure. why the thinking was behind it.
Well, when it came over from the Senate to the House, the first thing I did was figure out, okay, what's existing law? And when I saw that, I think it was pretty obvious, I think, as to everybody in the room, and I think most people in the legislature that our law needed to be changed, that it was draconian in nature and was outdated in terms of science and medicine. So we sat back and we had similar discussions with a lot of different representatives, a lot of different groups and people, and just trying to get our arms around what's the best public policy here. We appreciate the hard work that the Senate put into it. We appreciate the fact that worked across the aisle, and we're certainly committed to doing that in the House as well. Our version focuses more on the culpability of the infected person, and also on the fact that the victim here, the person that is not infected, that is being exposed, does not have that knowledge that the person with whom they are engaging in intimate contact is infected, so that they can't protect themselves. And while I fully appreciate the Senate's difference in whether there's transmission or no transmission, I think from the emotional, potentially emotionally traumatic perspective of the victim, that may or may not be of a great deal of comfort. And I do want to address the public health perspective on this, about some of the previous comments made about whether or not criminalizing this is a disincentive for people to go out and get tested, and that has a great deal of what I would consider to be superficial appeal and logic. But let's step back and think about this from this perspective, because this is how I actually looked at it when I was thinking about it. I'm somebody out there that I believe may be infected with one of these diseases, and I'm afraid to go get tested because I'm afraid that if I do get tested and I show up positive and then I go out and expose people afterwards without telling them, then I've committed a crime. So instead, I'm going to not get tested and continue to potentially expose people. I can't get over that hump. I can't get over the hump that people should sit there and not only disregard their own health, if they suspect that they have one of these diseases, they're going to not go get tested and not get treatment because they're afraid that if they thereafter go out and act irresponsibly or with the intent to infect somebody else, then that's a crime, so therefore they're not going to do that now. That does not click in the logic world that I look at. So I fully appreciate the public health interest in trying to make sure that people who suspect or think that they may be infected need to get tested. And that through testing and treatment, thankfully we've got some great treatment regimens out there now, that we can substantially reduce, if not eliminate, the risk of transmitting any of these diseases. I fully appreciate that. But if somebody is going to come to me and say, I don't want you to make this a crime because if I suspect that I'm infected and I go get tested and then I continue to expose, then that's going to cause me to not get infected. I can't get there.
Senator Hogue, how do you approach that?
Well, I actually think there is some validity to the argument that this law has become a deterrent to testing, I sit there and I hear what Representative Baltimore is saying, and I say, well, that kind of makes some sense. If I think I've got a disease, I want to get tested. No, right? That's the way I kind of rationally address these things. But you know, a lot of what we deal with in the criminal law, you know, you look at the stuff and it's not necessarily people making sort of decision making after they've charted out the, you know, they've put out their pros and cons list and they've sort of really thought about it. There, it creates a culture. And the data show that Iowa has a significantly lower testing rate than other states. And there may be other factors with that, right? It's not just this law causing that, but we've got to address that problem. And, you know, the word of mouth, the perception, people's feelings, and all of this goes into creating creating for some people, apparently, a barrier to getting tested. We want to encourage testing. And more importantly, we want to encourage treatment, and we want to encourage people to follow their behavioral recommendations, which is why, you know, in the bill, I think it's so important to have some kind of safe harbor that says, if you're doing what your physicians have told you to do, if you're following that treatment regimen, that's really important. I know what Representative Baltimore is saying about he's looking at the culpability. And I understand that. That's one of the factors we look at. I think whether the disease is transmitted is also a relevant factor. And I also do think this is an issue that we can find a way in a divided government to get to a solution on. And just for, you know, I've been talking to advocates, I've been talking to people who care strongly about it. Very rarely does anybody get a perfect bill out of the Iowa legislature. And to me, the test is it going to make our law, in some appreciable way better than it currently is? And I think we can get there. I really do think we can get there.
So the House bill now, is it in committee? Is it back in the Senate floor now? Where do we stand with the ping pong of the bill going back and forth?
It has passed the House Judiciary Committee, and it passed unanimously there too. And we will continue to work on it. I would echo Senator Hogue's sentiments that I'm optimistic that we'll get something done this year. We still need to vote on a bill or this whatever version we come up with on the House floor, and then it will go back to the Senate. When it was in committee, I made it very, very clear that we would continue to have discussions and we will continue to look at particularly the safe harbor there and what's the best way for us to take the science that is available, acknowledging that advancements in medicine and science are going to continue to come, thankfully, and we're very, very pleased about that. But we want to make sure that the law accurately reflects those. And, you know, again, going to the culpability of someone, if they are told by their doctor, hey, listen, you may be infected, but if you're taking this treatment and doing the right things, there is no real risk of transmission. I don't consider that to be a crime. I really don't. And so so I'm hopeful. And going to the comments of Senator Hoag about Iowa having one of the lowest testing rates, I think that probably reflects the current state of the law, which I think we all acknowledge is not the best public policy for us to have right now. So I think we're committed to working on it, and we'll continue to do so.
Senator Hoag?
Yeah, I just people who have not served in the legislature don't always appreciate some of the real difficult intricacies on working on legislation. This place is filled with personalities, different philosophies. And this issue's been around, actively under consideration, for at least 2 years, maybe before that. I can't really remember back in 11, 12 where we were on it, or 09, 10. But so this issue's been around, and I think we're at a point where we've had some discussion on it, and I think we can get to a place that that people will see as significant improvement over our current law. May not be exactly what they want. I know we did that on the Senate side, right? It was a lot of work because, you know, people feel strongly about these issues. And they say, well, we kind of need to do it this way. And then you're looking around, do you have the votes? Not only do you have 26 votes, you know, I was hoping to get over 40 votes. So do I have 40 votes to do that? And I ended up getting 48 votes, which I was very grateful for. Again, very proud of the Senate for doing that. But, you know, when we went to vote on the floor, I didn't know it was going to be 48 votes. I was hoping for 40 or more. So you get to a point where you're saying, okay, so that's going to get some bipartisan appeal. Now the House has to go through that process, and they're going through it. And I continue to be optimistic. But you know, people outside this building might just say, well, why don't you vote it up or down, right? I've heard a lot of people say that on other issues. Right? Just vote it up or down. Well, that's not the way this place works. There's a political process that we go through, political in the good sense, right? Hopefully in right. The good sense. There are some political processes that are a little uglier. But go through the process, have people have their say, and deal with it. And I continue to think we're getting to a point where we will be able to pass something and get to consensus on something.
So there will be some kind of compromise, you think? Both of you feel pretty good about that.
I do.
Okay. Well, we'll move on a little bit. Not every day we have the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee and the Senate Committee. So I want to talk about a couple other things going on. Both houses of the Iowa legislature passed legislation aimed at toughening criminal penalties in response to the kidnapping and slaying last year of 15-year-old Kathleen Shepard of Dayton. Representative Baltimore, what would the House legislation look like? What does the law look like?
Sure. The House version would do a couple of things. First of all, it would increase the penalty for kidnapping a minor to 25 years, Class B felony. That's assuming that there's been no serious injury or sexual assault, but just your to the extent that you can call it standard kidnapping. Of a child. And then the other half of the House bill says that if you commit a violent felony or a sexual felony against a child, then when you're convicted, you do not get time off for good behavior. The current law, and certainly the law that was in place when Mr. Klunder was originally charged and convicted several years ago, provides that if you behave yourself in prison, you get 1.2 days reduction in your sentence for every day that you serve. So each day constitutes 2.2 days on the actual calendar.
And you're talking about Michael Klunder. This is the, right. The man who was the one that kidnapped.
Yeah, the murderer, kidnapper, right. And murderer here. And that was the provision that allowed him to only – required him to only serve 19 years out of a 41-year sentence. And we've made some changes to the law since then, which have been beneficial. But I guess our approach is there are plenty of other ways to incentivize good behavior while they're behind bars. When you're committing a violent act or a sexual act against a child, I would prefer to put those people behind bars for the whole sentence rather than trying to provide incentives for them to get out early.
Senator Hogue?
Yeah. So we have a bill that increases the penalties, makes a Class B felony to kidnap a child under the 17 or younger. Representative Baltimore talked about not a sexual assault or not a violent torturing situation. That's because if it's that, it's a Class A felony and you're looking at a life in prison without parole in Iowa. So we're looking at the kind of lesser kidnapping offenses. We have a provision that says if you commit two kidnapping offenses that don't meet the Class A or Class B standard currently, so these would be Class C felonies, on your second offense, that becomes a Class B felony. And so we're ramping up the penalties. The murderer of Kathleen Shepard had multiple kidnapping offenses that he had been in prison for. And so this bill would have addressed that. On the earned time issue, that is not something that I personally believe in changing. And it's not because I want these terrible people to get out of prison early. It's because two things. One is no correctional officer, no law enforcement officer, no public safety officer has ever said we should get rid of earned time that I know of. My understanding of it is it's an effective tool for prison population management. And it's the only real incentive we have for somebody who is incarcerated to get treatment while they're in the prison system. So I am hopeful here that we can get to just the increase in the penalties part for the kidnapping offenses, leave the earned time to be discussed in a future legislative session.
Representative Baltimore, are you addressing a concern that this could be an emotional legislation that comes from one terrible incident but could have unforeseen effects on other cases? How is that concern addressed?
Well, I think that we try to set public policy in this building, not always having the full facts ahead of future instances ahead of us. And that's always a challenge, I think. And I think Senator Hogue and I both acknowledge that that's sometimes a bit difficult. When it comes to the earned time credit, the time off for good behavior, again, I think there are plenty of ways to incentivize inmates on behaving themselves or taking the sex offender treatment classes. Take away their television privileges. I think most guys that have been incarcerated for a couple of decades, if you take away some of their privileges, if they would go to treatment, that's probably a better incentive, honestly, because it keeps them behind bars. I can't see, here, go get some treatment and we're going to let you out early. Because when they've committed these kind of acts, quite honestly, I think the data would show that oftentimes they do go back out and reoffend. And so the efficacy of the classes themselves for somebody that's behind bars and for a couple of decades and then is let out, I think has to be questioned. And whether you're going to let them out early and hope and pray that the efficacy is there is probably, in my opinion, heading in the wrong direction.
Senator Hogue?
Well, we're not basing our policy here on a hope and a prayer, although I believe in hope and I believe in prayers. What we're doing is we're saying, let's make that base sentence longer. But still, if there's a possibility somebody's going to be coming out of prison, which over 90%, maybe 95% of our inmates are going to come out someday, and they need treatment, you need incentives for it. If you want them to learn good behavior, do that. I should mention another bill we passed, and I believe it's alive and well in the House, which is on changing our law to allow for civil commitment when a person as a juvenile commits a sexual offense, which mm-hmm. is also a Michael Klender instance. Civil commitment is an alternative, which gives the state the ability to say somebody's about to come out of prison, but we believe they were a sexually violent predator who have shown some likelihood to reoffend. We give the state the ability to go in and say, let's keep that person confined in a civil commitment. And expanding that law would have helped address the Klender situation as well.
And we fully support that concept too. It was a separate bill in the House as it kind of made its way through, and I think the Senate put the two of them together and brought over. But we've got no problem with that, and we'll be passing that part, certainly.
And this is where the conversation has to end, guys. Senator Hogue, Representative Baltimore, we could probably talk to you guys for a few more hours about all the issues in your judiciary committees, but thanks so much for being on River to River today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. Podcasting and on-demand audio of River to River are available on our website, iowapublicradio.org. We always welcome your questions and comments about the program. Email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.